This is a Suno India production, and you're listening to the Suno India Show. Welcome to the Suno India Show, a weekly news show brought to you by Suno India, a podcast platform on issues that matter. In the row of bills introduced by the government, the National Medical Commission Bill is an important one. Introduced in the Lok Sabha in 2017, it has now been passed by both Rajya Sabha and Lok Sabha. A bridge course for Ayush students, exit test for medical students, regulating private and deemed institutions, MBBS and postgraduate fees, and the government control over NMC members are the major themes that were brought up. It will majorly impact the medical education, trained doctors and other medical caregivers. It will also repeal the Medical Council of India and replace it with National Medical Commission that will be chaired by a government-nominated personnel. The dynamic changes to higher central government control when medical community has been demanding a more transparent governing body. In this episode, our editor Padma Priya speaks with Ms. Sujata Rao, former Secretary of Health and Family Welfare, to understand what these changes will mean.
Do you think that the NMC regulations will actually be adequate enough to sort of centralize and do away with the concerns that different states have with regards to the medical decisions? And reading through the bill, it seems like a lot of the power is actually going into the hands of the central government, and the NMC, the committee in itself, seems to come across as an advisory board. So could you just throw a bit of light on that aspect of the bill itself?
Yes, that's true that the central government has a lot of powers under the NMC, which was not so in the former MCI bill. The current one in the NMC Act, yes, central government has a lot of powers. And they can intervene almost in every critical decision that the NMC could make. And second, even in the composition of the different memberships of the different boards, it's the government that really has the upper hand, Government of India. So to that extent, yes, you are right. If the central government really wants to intervene and virtually, not allow NMC to function, it could. But it all depends on, these are all interpersonal relationships. It all depends on how much the government will respect and allow the institution to function and how much they want to make it subservient to themselves. As such, there's no perfect model. So, it depends on the personalities that are involved, the minister, the different stakes that are involved, how high the stakes are, what kind of people are appointed in the NMC, what kind of issues that arise. So there are a lot of concerns, that go around that, and the relationships really have to be often developed through convention rather than by the law book. So let us see how it pans out.
And just in terms of the kind of flexibility the state will have, if one reads through the Section 45 in the bill, it does look like, when can like the center override NMC suggestions, and how much flexibility do you think states will actually have? Say there's a dispute.
The states have no flexibility at all. If you notice in the last part of the act, central government says that they have a power to issue any kind of direction, even if it is not related to the policy. And the states have no option but to comply with it. So the states absolutely no discretionary power to agree or disagree with the act, with the central government or the NMC. They're completely subordinated in that context in terms of the NMC and the medical education.
So the other big question is linked to one of the biggest complaints is of the commercialization of medical education. In your opinion, do you think that the bill sufficiently addresses this practice of, the unethical practice actually of commercialization of medical education? Do you think enough steps have been taken to counter this?
See, what they have done is right now, even though this, according to the Supreme Court directive, no private medical college can levy a fees arbitrarily. They're supposed to be tribunals headed by a judge who's supposed to be, the tariff committees are supposed to be constituted, headed by a judge, and it's they who set the fees that the private sector colleges can levy. But the, it hardly acts, as you know very well, the informal payments are going on, and a lot of capitation fees is charged under the table for which no receipts are given. Now, the hope in the people who have drafted this NMC Act is that this kind of a contingency for having to take capitation fees under the table will now be gone, because 50% of the private sector seats, you know, the private colleges, they are open to being charged whatever they want. I mean, the management has full powers to charge whatever fees they deem fit. So in that case, they don't necessarily have to, you know, hide behind technicalities or do anything under the table. They'll upfront say, this is our fees and you pay, please pay for it. Having said that, the expectation that each one will now charge 4 crores, 5 crores, it hit the roof, may not necessarily be too true, because there is a market. If any college, even Apollo, charges 3 crores for an MBBS seat, maybe there are no takers for it. So markets are expected to be a sobering effect on the kind of fees that they can charge. The objection of many people to even this limited flexibility that has been given to private managements arises from the fact that even if they were to charge 50 lakhs or 1 crore for a seat, it commercializes a certain number, in this case it will be almost 20,000 seats a year, to doctors who have not so much merit but the ability to pay. They get into the profession, and their commitment to the profession may not be that sincere or that long-standing as a person who is very passionate to want to be a doctor, but he doesn't have the money to pay for the seat, and so he doesn't happen to get into the profession. The second thing is that once you pay 2 crores or 3 crores or 4 crores for an MD seat, you're compelled, either you take a loan or you sell your assets to raise that kind of money. And in that case, you really do get bound to want to work in urban areas, in big hospitals, in well-paying jobs, rather than go to rural areas or work in public health or work in such specialties that may not be so remunerative in the market. So it does bring in a slight amount of distortions and the risks of also corrupt practices, because such doctors who have a big, huge loan on their back could resort to unethical means all the time to try and raise their revenue base. So it is the whole profession then that gets corrupted, even though you might say that, you know, in net effect, it's only 25% of the seats that have been allowed to be commercialized. But the practice in principle and in how it's going to work out is definitely not a healthy trend. And I, for one, am totally against any such commercialization of medical education in India. And we've seen the pitfalls of such a practice in the U.S. This is borrowed from the U.S. and the distortion that it has created in the U.S. health markets is very clear to see. I mean, knowing that, why we are following that same model.
Yeah. The other contentious part of this bill has become the part about the six-month bridge course, which will allow community health practitioners to, you know, get a light.
That's an old one. The new one that has been passed by the parliament doesn't mention any bridge course. It only mentions that there will be a community health provider, CADA. And these community health providers will be allowed and delegated some powers of prescription. Right now, only an MBBS doctor licensed by the MCI can prescribe drugs. But in this case, by this act, the government can notify rules. And under those rules, whoever complies to the rules, those set of providers may not be MBBS licensed by the MCI, by the NMC board, can be permitted to prescribe certain drugs that fall in that category. The Act also does confine it not from Ayush and all those kind of people that were previously allowed. It's only those category of people who are related to the modern medicine. Now, that again opens up many windows. The intention of the government of India is to allow nurse practitioners. But in this case, the way they have worded it, it could even be a lab technician, it could be a pharmacist, it could be any other non-medical person working in the allopathic field who could be given powers. Now, it has to be, we have to see how the rules are going to be framed, what kind of constrictions they put, what kind of supervisory mechanisms they put, what kind of prerequisites they lay down. All those kind of things will have to now be seen. But more importantly, some of it I do agree, some amount of delegation of powers to people like nurse practitioners is welcome. But, you know, one has to see that it's not abused. You see, the whole problem comes in because in India, our ability to enforce laws is very weak. And as you know, already with none of the legal provisions, we have a large number of quacks who are prescribing all kinds of drugs. All kinds of people are prescribing drugs, and we have a huge antimicrobial resistance growing. So in such a scenario, now to also legalize a certain category of people is fraught with some amount of risk. But we'll have to see now that it's passed, we'll have to wait and see what the rules come up with.
Sure. One of the things that you actually did mention also in the Hindu article was about the model that Chhattisgarh has adopted, where there's a 3-year training that's sort of given to community health workers. Could you sort of elaborate a bit more on that? And why do you think, this is not being scaled up in other states?
Well, Chhattisgarh was one of the first to come up with this 3-year public health assistance kind of public health doctors or public health practitioners course. And they learned basically everything that an MBBS doctor would have learned in the first 3 years, except for invasive or surgical procedures. So the focus of their training was essentially public health. So they didn't know how to do an operation. They didn't know how to do many of the invasive procedures that a medical doctor should be doing. So they were eminently suitable for a rural area, where essentially what the knowledge that you need is to treat a TB patient, a malaria patient, minor fever, snake bite, dog bites, first aid, stabilizing an emergency case and early referral, diagnosis, doing a BP, identifying whether anyone has, diagnosing anyone having early diabetes, promotive and preventive health, and so on and so forth. So that can easily be done in 3 years. And evaluation showed that they were extremely well trained. They were all trained in medical colleges and they were extremely good. So, but then the MCI naturally threw a big fit, and they forced the Chhattisgarh government not to proceed with it. I think there were probably some court cases also put, and that's how they sabotaged the whole course. Even though Chhattisgarh had an act which made this three-year course a legal course. So, and that's a great pity, because that's exactly like the old licentiate of medical practice that the British had introduced during pre-independence India, which had served us very, very well. It's a pity that we banned them in 1947 when we got independence. It's a pity when we're trying to attempt at revival of that has always been sabotaged by the allopathy lobbies, the doctors' lobbies, the MCI in particular, the IMA. All these bodies have strongly withstood that attempts to revive that course. So that has gone, and I just strongly feel that that's an excellent model to follow, and we should all expand and work on that. But I don't know if we can or not. Let's see. If it's under this NMC, they can revive it.
Okay. The other question that I had was regarding this new exam, the next exam, where they said final year students will take this exam, which is a test aimed at common nationwide standards. And this one exam will grant the graduates the degree, but also depending on the scores and entry into the postgraduate courses. You know, there's been so much of controversy already around NEET. So I'm just trying to understand, do you think this idea of NEXT would be successful? And, you know, do you think it's implementable in such a large scale?
You know, I really, frankly, I have no idea, because I don't think, at least I'm not aware of any country which has a NEXT. As I had said in my article, it is an idea that was borrowed from the UK. So UK itself is struggling how to implement the NEXT. Their idea in UK was that there should be, by definition, somebody called a British doctor. That British doctor, whether he studied in the north of England or south of England, in Oxford or Cambridge or some small university or Glasgow or whatever, the standard of the doctor is same, the quality is the same, and that satisfaction is given to the patients because he passes through a uniform exam, which is the NEXT. So this they felt was, it's like a pilot's exam. You know, anyone who passes the pilot exam, you don't go question in every plane that you really know how to drive the plane or not. You take it for granted that he has put in those many hours of flying. You take it for granted that he has the requisite capabilities and skills to fly a plane, whether he's 5 years old pilot or he's been piloting for the last 50 years. There's a certain standardization. In our country, such standardization isn't there. And in UK too, they felt that such a standardization would be possible if they had one common exit exam. It would also thereby put pressure on all colleges to ensure the minimum standard in all their students. While some like Oxford or Cambridge might do much, much more than the standard, but everyone would at least be of a uniform standard. So that was the idea. Good idea, but it's very difficult to implement. And in our country, it would be quite a challenge, largely because what we can enforce in a country like ours and the size like ours is multiple choice questions. But health, medical science is not amenable to a simple yes or no or A, B, or C. It requires bedside exams, it requires viva voce, it requires a whole lot of other set of exams too. Now, how they're going to be able to do that is my concern. And I'm a little bit more worried because in the process of advocating for NEXT, they've also reduced the need for inspections of medical colleges, which is, you know, in the like what Dr. Harshvardhan said, we have now removed Inspector Raj. But there should be an Inspector Raj where medical science is concerned. There must be inspectors going concurrently and visiting colleges to say whether really the teaching process is on, the quality is good. You know, the quality has to be regularly good. It's just not a final exam output. They must be doing those cases properly. They must be taught properly. So now if you don't have a concurrent evaluation, as I might call, you might call it inspection, I might call it evaluation. If you don't have that kind of a process and you just say, whatever it is, you mug your way through, get into the exam and pass and I'll give you a rank and you get into MD, I think being a bit naive and simplistic and it's very difficult to implement and we may not necessarily get the best. So I'm a bit wary, but I don't know. The experts around there, I'm not an expert. I'm not a medical educationist. Maybe they figure out a good balanced approach. We have to see how they're going to do it, but it's a pretty tough deal. But if it works out, it's good. Because, you know, right now, the kind of every MBBS doctor steps out and all he's doing is mugging for his MD exam. So, you know, if you can remove that level, maybe they'll focus on their MBBS course and not waste their time preparing for yet another exam.
Correct. The other question that I have is linked to the shortage of doctors, medical professionals rather, and also, you know, we have a very poor doctor-patient ratio. There's also not enough credible data to actually estimate this. But just in terms of, you know, the shortage of doctors, especially in rural areas, do you think that the bill has actually done anything or said anything to actually address the shortage of doctors in rural areas?
Not specifically, but they hope that the NMC will do the planning and the human resource estimations and match it with disease burden and then and so on. I mean, there is a greater hope that this NMC there is a potential for this NMC to address these kind of issues much more than the previous MCI. So to that extent, it's a step forward. But, you know, one doesn't know what kind of people are getting and what they do. But nothing specifically. They never said anywhere in the bill that you will address this issue. They are only supposed to do HR planning and resource estimations. So let's see how they work it out. I don't know. The bill by itself is not is silent on that.
Right. Finally, in terms of the ongoing protests by the doctors' fraternity, one of the biggest concerns that has been constantly raised is about the licensing, you know, and giving more sort of power to the community health workers and so on. What are there any other reasons where this angst is stemming from for the doctors? And what do you think can be addressed to sort of now, you know, assure the medical fraternity with regards to the NMC bill in itself? Because now that it's passed, you know, it's there now.
But they've woken up a bit too late. They knew that NMC was on. They knew that it was going to be tabled. They never did educate their members of parliament. They never talked to their governments. And now after the bill is passed, to just go on doing dharnas is rather foolish, I think. The act is done. Now they must try and see that, talk to the central government and see they get a fair representation to be engaged with the way in which rules are made so that it does not encourage any kind of, undesirable, you know, the rules may be good, but they may have undesirable outcomes. So they can help the government in that context. But, you know, I think the intention of the government was never really to dilute the medical profession as such. They were only trying to be a bit more realistic to try and address the very huge problems we have in our country, where medical doctors are just simply not going to the rural areas. So some of them for very, very valid reasons, but government has not got the resources to address those valid reasons. So there is a little bit of shortcutting that they're doing in hoping that other cadres can be promoted so that we can address the major issues that we're facing of providing some kind of healthcare in rural areas. Essentially, that is it. But, you know, we should see that that doesn't get abused in the process. What do I say about the medical fraternity? Why they're basically, they're saying, why are you allowing non-medical people the right to practice? And what's the need for us to study medicine if people who haven't studied so much also have the right to practice our profession? They're right in that sense, absolutely correct. But then at the same time, I think I see this as a short-term measure. And let's hope it is a short-term measure. And as more number of doctors come and more doctors go into rural areas, the problem will die by itself. So we'll have to wait for that kind of time.
Yeah. I actually missed one question. And this is regarding the Ayush. Do you think, just like, you know, there are a lot of, for instance, when I spoke to a Unani doctor a few weeks back to do another story, one of the things that he was saying is that there should be like a mechanism for us to also sort of get mainstreamed, which I thought was very interesting considering that, you know, they all have like the alternate medical systems in India have their own specific places within the communities. So just in terms of that, do you think there is a need to mainstream the Ayush, or are they already mainstream?
You know, Ayush already has a whole ministry, which was not the case. It was a division once upon a time of the Ministry of Health. Today, it has become a full-fledged ministry with its own minister. Now, it is for the profession there to raise its own credibility by providing good quality services. I find a large number of people going to Kodaikal and all that for Ayurveda treatment there's an increasing number of people turning to homeopathy, for example. I myself have greater faith in homeopathy than allopathy. So it is not as if government has mainstreamed it or not mainstreamed it. It is an individual perception as to what. But I may never go to Yunani because I don't know what it's like and I won't trust it. So, you know, it depends on the Yunani or the relative disciplines to come up, and they have enough number of colleges, they have a large number of their own practitioners. It is for them to market themselves, do good treatment, provide evidence of people having actually been cured and so on. I mean, after all, you look at yoga, how it has picked up. There was nothing that government did at all. It was just that people began to sense the benefit of yoga. It's only now recently that this prime minister has paid some official attention to yoga, but it was growing even before that. Maybe because it became so popular in the West, perhaps it's because of that. But today you find a large number of people with diabetes, with hypertension, going to yoga for getting themselves a permanent cure. So these alternative medicines can't try to piggyback on allopathy and hope to get through the back door and do some allopathy medicines and also then stay relevant. I think that is not a very wise strategy. I think they just need to build their own disciplines.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Suno India Show. For regular updates, do subscribe to our newsletter on our website, sunoindia.in. And you can also follow us on Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or any other podcast apps that you use.